Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 14th of January. It's 14 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. We are thrilled you are all with us, and we are happy because we are ending the week, but we get to do so together and to talk about the issues of the day. We have a great group assembled. I'll introduce them to you in just a moment. While I prepare to do that, I should say, I will remind you that you can be part of the program by writing to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. It's fun, it's easy, at least for you. Sometimes it's painful for us, but for the most part, it's pretty nice for all parties involved. panel@wamc.org. Alan Chartok, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I see you through the window.
I see you. You're there.
I see you. You look terrific.
As do you. Good morning. It's good to be here. We are very excited to welcome other folks, including Albany County District Attorney David Soares. Good morning, David. How are you?
Hey. With a lead-in song like you just played, how could you not be having a great morning?
That's Peter Frampton's album, Frampton Forgets the Words.
Wow.
Cool. Reminds me of me.
So keep that in mind, David. Keep that in mind. We also welcome SUNY New Paltz communications professor and former New York State Senator Terry Gibson with us. I should note also a professor at RPI, which used to be in my script and somehow fell off, and I don't know why. But good morning, Terry. How are you?
Oh, you know, we know you just make these things up as you go along. That's all right. That's okay. You know, you can call me whatever you want.
You know,
I'm really happy to be here and appreciate the opportunity.
We always love having you here, and I thank you very much for joining us. Our Friday regular, and I'm thrilled that she's always with us, and that's Judith Enck, senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, former EPA regional administrator. Good morning, Judith Enck. How are you?
I'm good, and the title I'm proudest of is Friday Regular.
Yes.
You know, it's like a dish at a diner, but... I think the word of the day that I want all our wonderful listeners to look up right now is HYGGE from Denmark and Norway. That's the weekend we should all be having.
Which means fun, right?
Yeah, it means coziness and comfort when you're kind of driven indoors during long, dark winters. Mm. Wool socks, board games, candles. And then, of course, on Monday, reflecting on the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr., but Saturday and Sunday, HYGGE. Google it.
How did you become familiar with this Danish term?
Well, because I live it every winter.
Okay.
I don't have a lot going on. So I've read about this. I just don't know how to pronounce it. It's someone will help us. I looked at the phonetics, and I'm still afraid.
All right, hold on. You ready?
To try to.
You ready?
Judith,
yeah.
Judith, I know. Judith, it's pronounced playoffs.
No. That's the word.
Yeah, that's good. All right, hold on, Judith. Here you go. Did you hear that? Hygge?
Hygge. That's why I can't say it. Say it again. It's hard.
Yeah, it is. It is hard. Hold on. One more time.
Hygge.
Yeah, Hygge. According.
That is so cool.
Hygge. Yeah, Hygge.
Yeah. Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
All right.
It's a whole lifestyle. I don't want to derail the show. Just Google H-Y-G-G-E.
So I would spell this. I would spell this phonetically. H-U-E. Hygge. G-U-H. Hygge. That's how I would smell it, phonetically. Yes.
Did I hear David Gustina saying it's going to feel like 45 below zero?
I don't know. Did we hear that?
That is unbelievable.
It is going to be sub-zero without the wind chill.
I'm talking with the wind chill.
On about HYGGE.
I see. I can find the forecast. A wind chill advisory now in effect from 7 this evening to noon Saturday for us. Wind chills 15 to 25 below.
Well, we'll have to get Christina in here.
And then a wind chill warning effect is in effect for, for you, Alan, not for this area, but for Western Massachusetts.
Way over there.
Yeah. Wind chills as low as 30 to 45 below zero.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
That I'm doing the very safe thing of reading things from the garbage can. And
I can help you all pronounce phonetically our reaction my people would have to wind chills like that. And it's not spelled like that, Judith.
I'm afraid to have you pronounce it, David.
Yeah, I can't do it on this radio.
I didn't think so. All right. Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome. We have a lot to talk about, and so let's get right to it. A reminder, you can be a part of the program, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. If you have a Norwegian term you would like to share with us, please feel free. All right, let's go to the Supreme Court decision yesterday. This was a biggie. The not a big surprise, I think, but it was certainly the impact is a very large one on employers and employees across the country. The Supreme Court blocked President Biden's virus mandate for large employers. However, the justices allowed a vaccination requirement for healthcare workers at facilities that receive federal money. The Supreme Court on Thursday blocked the Biden administration from enforcing a vaccine or testing mandate for large employers, dealing a blow to a key element of the White House's plan to address the pandemic as coronavirus cases resulting from the Omicron variant are on the rise. But in a modest victory for the president, the court allowed a more limited mandate requiring healthcare workers at facilities receiving federal money to be vaccinated. So I just want to put this into perspective that the court decided that if you work at a healthcare facility that happens to receive federal money, then you should have a vaccination before you attend to people in a hospital setting.
I think that's what is being reported. What I don't believe is being reported was the basis under which the Supreme Court made these decisions. And it's kind of understandable if you follow their logic. And what they're doing is simply stating the same thing that they said a few months back when the issue of the CDC extending the moratorium on evictions. And what the Supreme Court was saying at that time was that the president, who occupies the executive branch of office, if the president had the authority to, through his agencies, to issue these very broad rules, right, then Congress would have specifically authorized that authority in the language that that grants the power to these agencies. And so in that instance, what you saw was the analysis of the Supreme Court and their determination that the CDC could not issue such a very broad decision that had such major economic and social impact. In this instance, what it's saying is that OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, in issuing that emergency temporary standard requiring employers who have over 100 employees vaccination or weekly tests, that OSHA also lacked the authority to do so in its statute and its authorizing statute. But what it did find is that with respect to the Secretary of Health, that the statute does grant the Secretary of Health the authority to issue vaccine mandates and other rules broadly, because that is in fact contained in the authorizing statute. So if you're keeping score, OSHA, no, CDC, no, but the Secretary of Health, yes. And that's the Supreme, they're forecasting this.
So the opinion, this is from the New York Times coverage, the opinion said more tailored regulations may be lawful given that, quote, most lifeguards and linemen face the same regulations as do medics and meat packers. So does that mean we will get more tailored regulations that could then be more lawful to help the linemen and the lifeguards?
It is signaling to the executive branch that that such a broad mandate, it would not be constitutional. But to go back and review the authorizing statute for OSHA, and then to tailor whatever they're planning to do next within the guidelines that authorizes the authority for OSHA, which I suspect would have to be language that perhaps looks at the size of the industry, that is more industry specific. But it's basically telling, you know, the executive branch, this is the path you have to take, because taking such a broad path as you did here will never pass muster.
I want to open this up to the rest of the group, obviously, but let me just ask this quick follow-up question, and that is, so how long would it take the administration, presumably, to come up with such guidelines in the sense of, you know, tick-tock, people are dying?
Well, if they did the regular federal rulemaking, it would take, you know, many, many months, if not years. What they should be doing is an emergency rulemaking, and they should have had it ready to go because they knew the makeup of the Supreme Court. And so I think, you know, the White House comments yesterday should have been, we're disappointed in the 1-6-3 decision, and we hear you, and here is our emergency rulemaking, as David said, to have the Secretary of Health do what they're trying to do. But we did not hear that yesterday. And I just want to remind people, what the Supreme Court struck down was a policy for large employers that the workers need to be vaccinated or wear a mask and be tested weekly. Sounds pretty reasonable to me. And just on a practical level, what I have not understood is if a worker decides not to get vaccinated, and I think they actually should be tested more than weekly, because often you're shedding the virus before you even know you have symptoms. But I think the folks who don't want to be vaccinated should pay for their own weekly tests. Why should, if you're a public employee, why should taxpayers pay for your tests? If you feel so strongly about this, shell out your own money to get tested, and then just hope that there's not disputes at the workplace on wearing masks. But, you know, this is where we are. I don't think any health regulation can be promulgated, you know, in the next few days, the next few weeks, that will allow us to deal with the worst parts of Omicron. And Omicron is now, you know, the vast majority of the cases out there.
Right.
And so it's much more infectious than Delta.
And Alan, I suppose we're not overly surprised. I know you've said this many times about this court's decision making on this, especially when you have one justice, Neil Gorsuch, who won't even wear a mask to listen to the arguments.
Well, look, this Supreme Court is not to my liking, to put it mildly. I think any pretense that judicial, and I'm very interested in what David was saying, for example, because he's a very great lawyer and he has, you know, a pretty good insight into this. He was treating it as if it was a serious issue from the court. To me, this court can always be counted on, probably 6-3, maybe one less if Roberts is on a good game. Can be counted on to do the wrong thing and the thing that they think will help Trump and hurt Biden. It's that simple. So I see it from a political prism, Joe, which I think is really what this Supreme Court has disgraced itself with up until now.
Terry Gibson, you have the choice of talking for 1 minute or letting me hold you till after the break.
I'll take you up on the minute. I think there's a couple of different ways to look at this. One of them is that clearly by putting the threat out there of these regulations on corporate America, many big companies have implemented vaccine programs and vaccine mandates, which they have the authority to do. And so I think that's good. Obviously, from my perspective and from those of us who want more protection in society, the Supreme Court ruling is not in favor of that. And it makes you wonder why the Biden administration decided to pursue this argument, knowing full well that it was likely to fail. And to Judith's point, they should have been ready with the emergency measures, which they seem to have the option to do. So I'm a little confused why the Biden administration keeps pushing these issues that are destined to fail without having a backup plan. And we can talk more about that later.
Absolutely, we will. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation after this news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartak, Judith Eng, Terry Gibson, and David Soares. David, anything you would like to add to your colleagues this morning?
Well, I think, you know, in fairness to the Biden administration, you're in the midst, you have a war room, and you're in the middle of a pandemic. You're seeing these numbers soar, and you've got to take action. I mean, he would have been criticized one way or the other. It's best to take your best shot and see where it all lands. But I do think that with this particular makeup of the Supreme Court, they've provided every single clue that they're not going to take into consideration the temperature of the day, which means, you know, 700,000 people that are dying, the massive spread. They're going to hang their hats on a strict construction of the law. Now, the question I think that the Biden administration has to be asking itself is, you know, how do we achieve similar ends, and which agencies could we look to their authorizing statute and use and weaponize to achieve those goals? And that's what they've got to do. In addition to, as Judith said, and I think Alan has said, in addition to going back to the drawing board and trying to develop measures that are perhaps industry specific, tailor those measures in a way that would conform to the strict construction that these judges are, in fact, that prism that these judges are viewing these laws through. And I think that's the advice that they have to consider.
So does anyone have a sense, to Judith's point and what David was just addressing, as to why the Biden administration would not have been ready with a follow-up? Alan?
Well, it could be. I mean, this is really just, you know, my guessing, but it could be that the Biden administration wants the citizens of the United States to know what a bunch of, what's the right word here, creeps are sitting on the Supreme Court and how political they are. And, you know, by doing that, you know, I'm impressed with David's basically following the argumentation that the justices used. But to me, it's quite simple. Anything that will hurt Biden, they're going to do. And if the shoe was on the other foot, they would be doing the exact opposite, in my opinion.
Well, it seems to me that if they were somehow wanting to put a spotlight on the conservative Supreme Court justices, it seems to me that being prepared to have these other alternative emergency measures to roll out immediately would be the best way to do that, because then they could call a press conference, they could acknowledge this defeat, they could point to their frustration with a conservative court that will not take into account the reality of what's going on in the world, and they could say, so we are now going to do this in response to that, and they could take a proactive approach to it and take the high road and show that they're actually doing something. And my concern is that the Biden administration needs to be much more visible, much more vocal every single day, showing that they are doing something and they are succeeding at doing it. And they are succeeding at doing a lot of things, but they're not getting the kind of press publicity and promotion they need. I think this was a missed opportunity.
Woulda, coulda, shoulda.
We have this that a letter from a listener that I wanted to read, and that is from Tom, who says, when I went to school, these matters such as this mandate were created by lawmaking. Executive power is the issue here, right? I went through the channels of lawmaking, then the people would be represented. I suspect the Democrats who are in power of Senate, Congress, and President realize there is not much public support for mandates of these sorts. What are your thoughts on that? Of is this, I mean, lawmaking, how does that work these days? And also the thought in the letter that is presented that there is not much public support for mandates. Polls would indicate, I think, otherwise, right, Judith?
Oh, yeah. You know, and it depends on what state you're in, but there's uniform support in many states for masking, for sure, for healthcare workers to be vaccinated. I mean, we'd have to look at the granular data, but I think the premise that the public doesn't support these policies is incorrect. And, you know, the sad reality is Congress does not seem capable of passing much of anything because of gridlock. And we have a health emergency in our hands. So it's absolutely within the boundaries of the executive acting to protect public health. And that's what they were doing here. And as Terry had mentioned, some companies went ahead and implemented the policy to great benefit. I think American Airlines said they have 100% vaccination and have documented the health benefits to their own workers, let alone the flying public. Companies like Amazon and Walmart hung back to see what the outcome of this case is going to be. So I really hope, and we haven't seen any signaling of this, but I really hope that over the next few days and maybe early next week, the Biden administration announces the Secretary of Health, as David outlined, does an emergency rulemaking. But also, as Terry noted, it is a missed opportunity because, you know, this decision didn't surprise anyone. And it would have been nice to be in yesterday's news cycle saying, okay, we disagree, but we expected this. And here's what we're doing now. I mean, this is too urgent an issue just to say we lost in court. We need to move on to other things. Our health cannot afford that.
Well, this Congress certainly is not capable of passing any type of legislation that would put mandates or regulations in place to deal with COVID or anything else for that matter. So it really does fall to the executive branch to try to figure out a way to take action. So they're clearly trying to figure out how to use the power they have, just to be a little more aggressive about it. I think what's about to happen here, to Judith's point, and she won't be happy to hear this, but I think what's about to happen is that the Biden administration is about to turn the boat around and start talking more about infrastructure, because he's going out today and giving a speech about infrastructure and about repairing bridges. And I think that they may begin to do probably what they should have done months ago and begin making these tours around the country and really popping up and talking about how mm-hmm. this money and the infrastructure mm-hmm. bill is going to really help America and be proactive and show that they're doing something. And they may just let this Supreme Court ruling, COVID, election reform, that may all just kind of fall off the radar and go back to being a behind-the-scenes discussion.
I will say that the one thing that is abundantly clear for me when it's come to the Democratic presidencies, and I'm saying this about both Obama and it's just been malpractice in terms of the use of that bully pulpit. You had one president who was fearful of going around, you know, the country and really, you know, banging on that bully pulpit to discuss, you know, health care. They passed, you know, one of the most incredible pieces of legislation historically, but did very little to tout it. And in this case, I agree with you, Terry, that, you know, they are going to go about talking about Build Back Better and infrastructure plans. But this economy is not coming back because as goes our battle, you know, with COVID-19 goes everything else. And I thought that at the beginning of this administration, they were really, really aware of that. And I believed early on they were taking all of the necessary steps, and their message was succinct But what's happened, I would say, over the last 3 weeks is you've had the splintering of mixed messages from the CDC along with the White House. And I'm really happy that they're talking about mailing, you know, tests to homes, because that's got to be part of the way, giving people the ability to fight on their own. But it's got to be complemented with both industry as well as consistency in messaging from the CDC.
We got this letter from Paul that says, yesterday's decisions made it much easier for me to envision a 7-2 court in 2025. Biden needs to pivot toward Justice Breyer's retirement now, right, so that we don't have, yep, another young Trump appointee on the Supreme Court of the United States for the next 25 plus years. Paul simply signs off by saying, yikes. Judith?
That battle is lost already, and I hate to be the downer in that discussion.
The Breyer battle or the overall battle?
It's the overall battle. You know, the fact that the Democrats relented and we relaxed on our posture with respect to getting judges through. You know, of course, now we're all principled about the filibuster, and we can't, you know, do anything on the filibuster to allow for voting. But we were willing to do that to allow for people to put their judges in. And people have no idea of the damage that was done to the judiciary over the course of the last 4 years. It's been an amazing damage. Not only to the Supreme Court, but all the appellate courts that one must travel through to get to the Supreme Court.
But at the same time, I don't disagree with that. But at the same time, Biden remarkably has gotten a record number of new judges, mm-hmm, appointed to the federal courts. And judges who are quite different than what we've previously seen on the federal court, judges that reflect the diversity of our country, who are now also coming from different career experiences, judges who've worked at legal aid, judges who represent public interest law groups. It's pretty remarkable. But I concur with yikes in terms of Breyer. You know, the numbers are not good on the Supreme Court. Most cases are really decided in the lower federal courts, not the Supreme Court. But we need every sensible jurist we can get. And what an ego Breyer must have. He knows his advancing age. He knows that we may not have Democratic control of both houses and the executive for much longer, and still he stays on the court. I mean, doesn't he have grandchildren or hobbies or travel he would like to do? Just move it along, guy. Come on. This is just so obvious.
Yeah, you know, I went down to New York City last weekend. I went down to the Historical Society Museum of New York, and they have an exhibit there on Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I walked through that. It's a beautiful, mm-hmm, exhibit. If you get a chance to go, it tells her whole life story. But as I walked through it, and certainly near the end of the exhibit, where it came near the end of her life, end of her serving in the Supreme Court, I could not get that thought of our mind. It's like, why didn't, yeah, she step down? Why, yep, didn't she retire when we, yep, had the chance to get another justice in her place? And it's very frustrating as you go through that exhibit. And I see the same thing happening here again with Breyer, and it is very frustrating. What are they thinking? So it needs to be addressed.
Alan, well, I would remind everyone here that what we see all throughout the body politic are individuals who put their viability before, you know, the interests of the country. I see, mm-hmm, members of the House putting their own, you know, reelection. I see people like, you know, Manchin and Sinema who you know, put their own political viability ahead of issues that are much larger than them. So this idea that jurists would be different in this climate, I think we're wishful thinking.
Alan?
Well, I think the remarkable panel has said what needs to be said here. Look, the Supreme Court of the United States is made up of politicians. You may not like that term. You may like lawyer more, but they are self-serving and they are politicians. And when you ask them to step aside for the good of the country, they don't think you're right. They think only I can do this. You know, we've seen it with presidents. We've seen it with others. And, you know, I think you can shake your finger at all of them, male and female and everybody else, and say you should have done better by us. But they don't believe it.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we have many letters. We'll get to those and we'll continue our conversation. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Terry Gibson, and David Soares. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Support comes from the Scagnelli Law Firm, Albany, New York, specializing in personal injury cases, working to help individuals seeking compensation for injuries for 33 years. ScagnelliLawFirm.com. And from EBS Originals, author Eileen Bluestone Sherman reads her audiobook, The Violin Players, A Jewish Girl's High School Introduction to Antisemitism. More at EBSOriginals.bookmark.com.
Forty-nine minutes past 9 o'clock on this 14th day of January. We welcome you to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Panel at WAMC.org. It is where Irene writes and says, when push comes to shove and the pandemic goes on and more people get sick, it is on record that Biden tried to protect the public by implementing policies that Republican-appointed justices wouldn't support. Wow, what a concept, protecting the public. It's a good letter. I just wonder, Alan, how much that record counts.
I don't know. You know, you got a whopping something like 34%. I'm not sure this is the exact figure, of the American people who are saying Biden's doing a good job. Clearly, there's an issue here about people and what they want. These polls are very troubling to me.
Maureen says this isn't about vaccination mandates. It provides an opening for these ideologues to deconstruct the regulatory state. There you go. Get ready for more of this.
True.
Yow, true, says Maureen. A lot of exclamations. Yes. Go ahead, Alan.
True. No, true. I mean, you know, look, we know where this is going. We know what these folks are up to. And they're getting away with it.
All right. We go to Craig, who says, my understanding was that part of the Supreme Court's logic was that COVID is not specific to the workplace and therefore not under OSHA guidance. The hypocrisy is, of course, that a fire is not specific to a workplace environment, but OSHA has many requirements about protecting from fire hazards. David.
Great letter.
Yeah, it's a very good letter, and I would agree with that. But, you know, one of the issues that the people opposing the mandates raised was the fact that the COVID-19 was not an occupational danger. And they also, what they did, which I thought was a bit creative, and I thought the justices were blind to it, you know, they raised the fact that the 17 months had passed, there was no effort in 17 months to move forward and pass such a regulation, therefore undermining the justifications that they presently had in calling for the mandate. And the justices went through that, accepted it, and I don't think they really they thought through the fact that there was a different administration in place And that's part of who completely denied the danger of COVID-19. And so in that case, you had these advocates that used an argument that certainly benefited them here.
Let's see. We go back to the letters. We go to Kate, who said, quite bizarre to promote the error that only the unvaccinated, uninjected with novel drug technology, are shedding viruses. You know very well that the injections do not prevent being infected and carrying the virus. It is unacceptable to propose that those who choose testing over being injected with a drug that has unexamined short and long-term consequences, and for which there is no one to sue if one is injured, maimed for life, or suffer death. Please know that this technology is, in fact, laden with risks. All right, so let's take Kate's letter as an example of the thoughts of many who are ultimately saying what she is saying to their employers, to their school districts, and to their communities at large. Judith.
Yeah, so it's not based in science. The vaccines have been approved. It is true that if you become ill from the vaccine, you can't sue the pharmaceutical company, but there is a reimbursement federal board, and that's why you don't take vaccines until there's federal approval. You can't prove that anything is 100%, but there is very strong peer-reviewed scientific data that she should read that showing there largely is not adverse health effects from taking these vaccines. And it is well documented by the hundreds of thousands of death certificates that there are adverse health effects of not taking the vaccine. If she doesn't want to take the vaccine, she should be tested more than once a week, pay out of her own pocket for the test, and wear the mask whenever in public places. But, you know, the great irony is a lot of the people who are arguing against vaccines also won't wear masks in public, and I don't see them paying for testing. So, you know, if this was an illness that was contained just to yourself, that might be a logical argument, although it's not based on science. But this is an infectious disease. And when it spreads to other people, there is a responsibility to make sure that you are not involved in making this crisis even worse. So I don't think the letter is grounded in reality.
Me neither. And just to dot the I and cross the T, we do have lots of testimony from the people who are running our hospitals saying that huge numbers of people who are infected did not get the vaccine. I mean, what do you want?
Well, not only that, but I mean, you can make your argument, both you and Judith, Alan, can look locally for information and data and proof of the efficacy of our vaccines. And we have the world, like literally the world is a petri dish, right? We've seen countries without vaccines and the devastation that COVID-19 and the variants have wreaked upon them. And then we have states and local communities, all of whom are tracking data because we're in the midst of a pandemic. And the idea that you know, okay, you're going to hold out because you have somehow, and I don't know what this individual does for a living, but I see this all the time. But all of a sudden, overnight, because we're watching, you know, one news channel over another, we've all become experts because we have the ability to go and hit a button on the Google machine. And I would agree with the statement that you made, Judith. Look, I mean, if this was an issue that involved you, fine. People smoke. People drink. People put a lot of things in their bodies and do a lot of things, you know, on their own that present just a danger to themselves. go about it. But in this instance, you're presenting a problem for your neighbors and your family members. It's a combination of arrogance and ignorance, and I'm sorry for being so bold in suggesting that.
And if I could just add one more thing, I really think that Kate and people who share her ideas should talk to their own medical doctor. You know, they trust their doctor to make wise decisions on their health care. So talk to your own doctor and drive her or him crazy, but talk to your own doctor and see what their independent, well-informed judgment is, because after all, they did go to medical school.
Terry Gibson.
I take some comfort in knowing that the majority of people walking around in this country understand the threat of COVID and understand the great benefits that this amazing invention called a vaccine has given us throughout the history of mankind. And most people are taking it, and most people understand that these things are good. And so there's always going to be an outlier, and we can continue to do our best to persuade them to look at science and deal with this in a serious fashion, but we'll never get 100%.
So what's behind their outlying? That's my question. In other words, this is such nonsense. What is it that's motivating this kind of a letter?
Well, I think we do live in a society today where you can access any type of information that you need to confirm that what you want to believe is real. There are just unlimited sources to confirm anything. There's a satirical conspiracy site out there right now called Birds Aren't Real that a young man created as a satire about how you can just make anything up. That satire is that birds aren't real. They're all drones, and the government is spying on us with birds. So anything you want to believe, there is a place where you can find it to believe it, and that's the best answer I have for you.
You mean all those little birds at our feet are drones?
They're all drones, and they eat a lot, I will say. We're spending a fortune on seed for those little robots. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many other items to discuss. We will welcome your letters, of course, panel at WAMC.org. First up, Ray Graff with news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning. It is the 14th of January, 7 minutes past 10 o'clock, and we have Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Terry Gibson, and David Soares on our panel this morning. Let us go to letters, and then we'll move on to other topics. Susan writes, are we sure that the Democrats could get a new appointee appointed in the Supreme Court? What would Manchin and Sinema do? Maybe we would be just creating a vacancy that would stay open until the next election when Trump could once again appoint an awful person.
Very good letter.
Well, it's called staff work. I mean, you check that out. You find out. You run names by Manchin and Sinema and see who they would vote for. You know, they can be proactive.
Judith, do you have any real idea what Manchin and particularly Sinema are up to?
I think Manchin is, there's a great article by WAMC friend Jeff Goodall in Rolling Stone a few days ago. I think Manchin is looking out for the interest of coal companies and not coal miners. And he personally makes a lot of money on coal investments. So I think what's animating Manchin more than anything is protecting the coal and fossil fuel industry. And Sinema, I have no idea. She is in orbit and so inconsistent.
That's right.
All right, let's go to this letter from Mark. People are tired of the doom and gloom of the administration and media around COVID. 80% of the population is vaccinated. Well, I don't think that's true, but okay. Half of the people getting treated—
In New York.
Yes, but not in
New
the country.
New York rates are very good, over 80%.
Half of the people getting treated for COVID today are vaccinated. The data clearly shows that vaccinations and masks are less effective than in the past. What people really care about is inflation and the rising cost of energy and food. Biden is doing nothing about this. In fact, he is fortunate that Build Back Better is dead, since that would make inflation worse. Biden was supposed to unite Americans. Does anybody think It is more united today than a year ago. Biden's approval rating is less than that of Donald Trump. David? Maybe David is not there. Alan?
Well, maybe David went away. But, you know, the present president is caught between the devil and deep blue sea, obviously. You know, on the one hand, he came into office thinking that if he did more for more people, he would be lauded for that. Instead, we do see that for a variety of reasons, many of them not his fault, we have a serious inflation problem in this country. And now, what does he do? Does he stick with the original plan, which is I'm going to do things that are going to put food on the table, stop children from starving, do right for people, and yet suffer the criticisms that come when you do that, that you're creating an inflationary spiral? And whether that's true or not, and I don't know if it is, I do know that you can't discount the fact that it is happening, and so therefore he's got a big problem on his hands.
Let me just say that I was about to make a, I was making a really great point, except I was doing it.
we thought mute. You went away.
On mute, which is my wife likes to hear my points more often. I think the administration came in with some incredible ambitious objectives, and they came in with some fantasies. And I think they spent a little too much time on the fantasies and not enough time on the more ambitious projects. And so, what I mean by the fantasies is this whole notion that somehow after the last 4 years, we're going to have bipartisanship again. And what do? They gave, you know, Joe Manchin time to bring some Republicans to the table. By the way, how many Republicans did he bring to the table? So, you know, I think they wasted a lot of time. I thought the fact that they weren't moving on the much larger spending bills sooner without the Republican support, I thought that, you know, it was going to come back and bite them. And also, it's like we've spoken, the incongruent approach to combating this pandemic is also rearing its ugly head to address issues now. But and I have to say that what I haven't heard anything about is the appeal to people like our senator from Utah. We keep spending a lot of energy on our Democratic senators who have been telling us that they don't love us. We've been spending all of our energy on those two senators, and we haven't made any kind of appeals that I can hear of to our senators from Alaska, from Utah, and some of these other senators who have demonstrated a streak of going against, you know, the Trump side of the Republican Party. And I just have to ask, what happened to good old-fashioned politicking where you're building bridges and ice rinks all over Alaska for a vote on something that you really need to get passed?
How do you explain that? I mean, how do you explain the fact, David, that the sensible Republicans have deserted en masse?
I don't know that there's been anything, because at this point, I would be in more in favor of contorting whatever policy and bending them to the will of someone like Mitt Romney than I am to Joe Manchin. Because on the political spectrum, I think you'd find probably Mitt Romney, you know, more in more favorable than you'd find Joe Manchin, who's a West Virginia Democrat who seems to be acting more like a lobbyist for the coal industry than he is a senator.
Yeah, fair enough. But Mitt Romney, David, was seen by many people, including me, as a fair player, as a guy who would listen to reason. And he's not anymore, nor are any Republicans. Is it all just fear of Trump and what he could do to you?
Yeah, that's entirely it.
Mitt Romney's safe, isn't he? Isn't Mitt Romney safe? In his seat,
they never they never feel safe if Trump's going to go after them. I think, Alan, that's the entire dynamic. If you've got, quote, reasonable Republicans who, you know, we always hear these reporters say and Democratic legislators say, well, you know, behind the scenes, these Republicans, including McConnell, think Trump is, you know, not responsible, et cetera. It's a nice way I can put it. But we have two Republican parties. We have the fading traditional Republican Party, and we have the party of Trump. And the party of Trump is dominant, and he demands loyalty. He flips out if you have a U.S. senator, for instance, saying, no, Joe Biden won the election. You know, the count is clear. So this is all about loyalty to Trump. And even though, you know, Romney is probably quite safe in his Utah seat, he lives in fear that Trump is going to recruit someone to run a primary. Look at Liz Cheney. Trump is determined to knock her off in a primary. So the Republican Party is lost. It's not really a Republican Party anymore. It's a Trump cheering squad, and they are very strategically moving to control things at the local level, to control how voting is done. And the Mitt Romneys of the world are terrified.
You know, I wanted just to go back to that previous letter writer and just say that I don't really think it's fair to say that Joe Biden hasn't accomplished anything and hasn't brought our country together. I mean, he has accomplished a lot. This infrastructure bill that he and the Congress passed recently in a bipartisan fashion is a really big deal and a huge accomplishment. The problem is that they haven't done a good enough job of marketing it and promoting it and selling it and explaining what a good thing it is. In terms of just the vaccines and COVID in general and then the safety of our country in terms of health, we are, even though it kind of feels some days like we're not, we are ultimately in a better place than we were prior to Joe Biden taking office. Certainly the economy is in a better place.
Yet only 35% of the American people believe that.
Yeah, but the other thing is that I think one of the other mistakes that the Biden administration is making is that in terms of reaching out and trying to create a more bipartisan atmosphere is that you have to look at what they're giving Republicans, those like Mitt Romney, what are they giving them to respond to? Are they giving them things to respond to that they can realistically expect them to support? This is why I think one of the real focuses ought to be taking this remaining Build Back Better bill, which has all this social spending in it, and breaking it out into individual components. And I think there they will get Republican support from the Mitt Romney types to help support some of these things, which are good. But the mistake they made was trying to go in and do it all together as this one big package, and it just wasn't realistic to expect them to respond favorably to that. So I think the strategy of this administration, much to what David mentioned earlier, has been a little based in Disneyland in terms of the reality of what they're confronting. And I think they're starting to figure that out, and I'm optimistic that moving forward, Biden's success will get a little bit better.
Let's go to a couple of letters, and then I want to move on to some other stuff. Is inflation really that bad, writes Robert? I remember the 1970s when interest rates were in the double digits and inflation seemed higher than it is now. Is it just that we have had little inflation over the last two decades and we have gotten used to the slow, stable increases in prices?
Yes.
Simple as that. Adam writes, every time our representatives from any party want to govern and invest in the people, markets punish those incumbents. The markets have the people under siege. Andrew writes, people being against vaccines and open to conspiracy theories which support those ideas has a lot to do with human nature. The reason people choose not to take vaccine lies in their attempt to take control of a situation that is not in any way in their control. Saying no to the solution creates a sense of agency that's going along with the solution does not. I don't believe during this incredibly uncertain time it is possible to have everyone agree on the best plan of action. Then we go to David, who says, I'm curious to understand what your panel believes is the reason anyone, Republicans or even the media, is still paying any attention to Mr. Trump at this point. He and his platform seem so irrelevant and old news. I don't understand why the GOP hasn't dropped him or moved on to a new party idol.
Well, I do. And what's happening here is that the Republicans and the polling and all the rest of it show obsequience, or if that's the right word, to Donald Trump. It's that simple. And all the little lemmings follow it. I don't think you have to look much further than that. Judith?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is the party of Trump, and it has been nice not fixating on him over the last year. But I think we need to go back to paying much more attention, because he is pulling the strings. He is the Republican Party. Whether or not he runs, he is controlling a lot. He's going to get involved in the midterms. And, you know, part of that apparatus also is to paint Joe Biden in the most negative way possible. And while I agree, it was quite unrealistic to think that Congress was going to cooperate and do the entire Build Back Better bill, I think we need to keep in context that Biden and Harris have been in office for less than a year, and they inherited quite a mess. I mean, the Trump administration really set out to decimate the federal government. So a year ago, you know, we were without vaccines. A year ago, Trump was still president, you know, spending a lot of time watching TV. And we were just out of, you know, January 6th. That was, you know, devastating to democracy. So I hate to sound like a stereotype here, but we got to give him a little time. It's been less than a year. We got certainly offer suggestions on how to do things differently, but it takes a long time to shift the ship, you know, the federal government on many things. And do not underestimate all of the time the agencies are spending trying to repair the damage of Trump. I mean, all of the environmental regulations that were repealed, EPA is methodically going through and trying to review them, strengthen them, get them back on the books. The same with OSHA, you know, the same with FEMA. I think Biden is restoring a sense of decency to the country. And he's trying to get these federal agencies to function better to protect the interests of the people. So that doesn't sell newspapers. That doesn't get you clicks. But that is the hard work of governing.
And it might not get you elected either, by the way. I mean, you know, you're looking at these polls. They're terrible.
Joe, if I could just respond to the letter writer as well. One of the things that Donald Trump was famous for, and those of us who lived around New York City in the 80s and 90s certainly recognize this, is that he was famous for slapping his name in gold letters up on giant buildings that he built or subsidized in some fashion. And he did the same thing to the Republican Party. He branded that party with big, giant gold letters. And it is still very much supporting his brand in a huge way. And So they just can't get away from that. They can't get those gold letters off of their party. And the media understands that they can sell a lot more ads and get a lot more eyeballs on their websites because he makes for great clickbait. Donald Trump, click, there you go. Another million people looking at this, more ads being sold. And so the media helps enforce this. And it's just this vicious cycle of the media keeps supporting Donald Trump. The party keeps supporting Donald Trump. No one else in the Republican Party comes anywhere near having the amount of interest to the American public than Donald Trump. I mean, if Ted Cruz says something or McCarthy says something or any of these other people, it's just not that interesting. And so this is why he keeps getting all the attention.
Is all lost?
No, I don't think all is lost. But we got
then why does it feel that way so often?
We got a lot of work to do because it's complicated, and because on a political front, Democrats have just made a lot of colossal mistakes over the last decade that are hard to recover from, and Republicans have done a lot of things in terms of investing in their party that have made them just stronger and more formidable. And they have this loudmouth brand that has just taken over the airwaves, and it's hard to compete with. But No, I don't think hope is lost, and I think that we just have to keep doing the work.
All right, so I want to get to a somewhat related subject, and it has to do with the Republicans and their quote-unquote strategy. So the Republican National Committee says it will require candidates to pledge to not participate in debates run by the Commission on Presidential Debates. What would replace them, if anything, remains unclear. This is from the Maggie Haberman article in the New York Times today. The Republican National Committee is preparing to change its rules to require presidential candidates seeking the party's nomination to sign a pledge to not participate in any debate sponsored by the Commission on Presidential Debates. I believe the full name of it is the Bipartisan Commission on Presidential Debates, but... Anyway, Republican committee officials alerted the debate commission to their plans in a letter sent Thursday, a copy which was obtained by the New York Times. If the change goes forward, it would be one of the most substantial shifts in how presidential and vice presidential debates have been conducted since the commission began organizing debates more than 30 years ago. The nonprofit commission, founded by the two parties in 1987 to codify the debates as a permanent part of presidential elections, describes itself as nonpartisan. But Republicans have complained for nearly a decade that its processes favor the Democrats, mirroring increasing rancor from conservatives toward Washington-based institutions. The move by the RNC was an outgrowth of these long-held complaints and came after months of discussions between the commission and party officials. According to the RNC's letter, the chairman of the party temporary presidential debate committee, David Bossie, began discussions late last year with the debate commission's co-chairman, Frank Fahrenkopf, a former Republican official. Oh, dear.
What's going on here, of course, is that the Republicans don't feel they're winning in those debates. And so, therefore, they don't want them anymore. Pretty simple.
Wouldn't it depend? Well, I'm sorry, Alan, but to that, wouldn't it depend on the candidate? I mean, to me, this was sort of like the biggest, not that we need any more, but the biggest evidence, the largest piece of evidence that we have that Trump is going to run for president again, is that you don't want the debates. But if you had somebody who could, you know, that was reasonable, let's say, that you wouldn't be as worried about them in a debate setting,
well,
right?
Well, there are people who think he won that debate with Hillary. He threatened her. He walked around her. You know, he was a terrible person, and he still is, of course. And even with this reticence on the part of the Republican Party, he is a guy who wrecked those debates.
So I'm assuming. Go ahead.
Well, let's look at the history. I mean, these presidential debates, which I think are really important, used to be moderated and organized by the League of Women Voters. And then in the mid-80s, the League of Women Voters stopped doing these because both Republican and Democratic parties wanted a whole lot more control, like the selection of the reporters, the composition of the audience, hall access. And the League of Women Voters threw up their hands after decades and walked away. And then you get this bipartisan commission set up. I think the bipartisan commission is fine. They've been functioning since the mid-80s. I mean, my issue with them is they've got lots of corporate sponsorship. Their consistent sponsor has been Anheuser-Busch. They're also sponsored by Southwest Airlines and my favorite, the International Bottled Water Association.
There you go.
But they are a
Are those plastic
nonprofit.
Bottles, Judith?
You bet they are.
Yes. That's probably why you have plastic bottles on the podium. But I think this is linked to what we were just talking about. It's always plastic. Trump thinks this is the bipartisan part of this is the old guard of the Republican Party, the old party that we used to know. And he just doesn't trust it. And I think he probably knows, even though Alan may be right that he beat Hillary in that debate, he knows that, you know, debating is not his strong suit. So this is all part of this orchestrated effort related to who counts the votes among Secretary of States. He's getting ready for a run, and he wants to change the rules of the game so it's most favorable to him.
This shouldn't surprise anyone, right?
Okay, so yeah. I'm gonna hold everybody here because we have about we only have about 10 seconds before we have to take a break. So let's do that, and then we'll have a steel cage match when we come back. It'll be lots of fun. David, Terry, get ready. We welcome
I'm
you.
I'm a lover, not a fighter.
It makes two of us. We'll be back right after this break on WAMC. Peter Frampton on this Friday morning edition of the Roundtable Panel, 33 minutes past 10 o'clock on the 14th of January. Judith Eng, Terry Gibson, and David Soares are making up the panel. Alan had to go to an appointment, so he left during the break. But when we last left, our group was talking about the RNC signaling a pullout from presidential debates. And I believe Terry Gibson had the floor. Terry, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I see this decision being more of part of a long-term strategy by the Republican Party. As I mentioned before, they've just been better over the last decade at building a long-term strategy, looking ahead. And I think they are now calculating that between the benefits that the Electoral College gives them with all of its insanity and the benefits that their gerrymandering and their voter suppression laws have put in place for them, that they really no longer need to communicate to a significant portion of America. They have a very limited targeted base. If they can communicate to that base in a way that gets them to turn out and vote, then they will continue to win. And that's what they're banking on. And I think they just have reached a point where they don't want to be told what they have to do and who they have to communicate with. And that's what these current debate setups make them do. I think they'll still debate, but they want to be in control of what the terms are.
David Soares.
Yeah, no one should really be surprised by this. This was probably the least shocking news, considering that the RNC the RNC appeared in their last convention with absolutely nothing to offer. In the court of ideas, other than to just be fully on board with whatever Donald Trump wants to say. So they offered no platform, which was completely an abandonment of their political and ideological principles. I think this desire to now pull out of, you know, the traditional debate structure is, I think, as Judith said, is greasing the runway and making it easy for people who are inarticulate, like the former president, having to be in that kind of form. I think it also does signal perhaps that he will be running again, and they don't want him to have to, you know, actually defend his ideas. But I think Terry makes perhaps the greatest point on this issue, and that is the calculation here, the long-term calculation. They currently have their own communication ecosphere, right? They do. It's Fox News, it's conservative radio, and then your traditional right-wing outlets on social media. So they, although they're a shrinking group, they like the group that they have. They think that their efforts at gerrymandering can maintain power. And that's their calculation. Other than that, this is really an absurd idea. And it's just one more institution that, is demonstrating that there's no level that they won't go, no depth that they won't sink to destroy our traditions in our country.
Judith?
Yeah, I don't have much to add. It's this is a kind of a basic tenet of democracy, you know, independent presidential debates, and if you lose that, that's a very bad sign.
I know this is going to sound like a really naive slash it's not naive. I have a point to it, but are we beyond the point where we can have a nonpartisan discussion? In other words, have debates even are they even important anymore given the current state of politics. Now, I agree with you, Judith. I think they're a tenet of our democracy, and I think it's how we find out. But given how things have shifted so, I don't know. It does. I mean, we tend to, after these, we make a big deal over these debates. We watch them, and I'm talking about all of us. We watch them, and then we come on the radio and we talk about who won points and who didn't, and who scored something and who didn't, and who looked good and who didn't. But I don't know. Is that important anymore? And to the question that is raised in Maggie Haberman's piece in the Times, is there something, and I guess this is ultimately my question, is there something that can replace them? Is there something that can replace what we know of as the formal debate that can help the people in this country make a educated decision on who to vote for president of the United States, if that is indeed what we want?
I don't think that there's anything that can replace a face-to-face, live, real-time conversation, debate, argument, screaming match, whatever you want to call it, between two candidates, regardless of what the party is. But certainly at a presidential level, I don't think you can replace that. It's part of the transparent democratic process that we have come to expect here in this country, and many other countries would like to have and don't have it. So when you take that away, you really leave it to the individual parties to develop their own communication platforms, which, as David was pointing out, the Republican Party has done a real good job of doing already. And voters really don't have a place to go where they can watch something without it being tainted by one side or the other's message. So it's just another one of those terrifying things that we need to be worried about.
David?
Well, there are people who watch the debates to listen to their, you know, potential representatives engage and defend their positions. I would agree with some of the observations. People have already decided who they're going to vote for. But there are things that happen during debates that, I mean, it just gives us so much material. I have to go back, and I'm thinking about the fly that landed on Mike Pence's
hair. Pence's hair, yeah.
In hair, you know. These are iconic imagery and also iconic moments that come from those traditions, like a debate. So the idea that all of a sudden one party decides that, hey, you know what, our ideas may not be – I think it demonstrates incredible weakness, too. They are now
right.
appealing to a fringe right. And it would be amazing to me to watch, you know, the next candidate running for office on the Republican primary. I mean, it's going to be a NASCAR race to the right. And perhaps that has something to do with them not wanting to have a formal debate and choosing, you know, their terms, because I just can't imagine what that would look like.
So, okay, David, what happens, and open it up to everybody, really, but what happens if in a, let's say, we're talking about the commission on debates, but when it comes to Republican primary debates, if you're holding them on Fox or OAN, do they already have a dog in the fight, and is it fair for other people? And let's say there are people, if Donald Trump is running and there are other candidates who are running against him and facing him in a primary, are they going to be open-minded too, or is that just going to be really a setup job? How does that play out?
Well, who's going to run against Donald Trump in a primary?
You don't – what'd you say, Judith? You don't have it?
I don't think you have a Fox or OAN debate because they're not independent. I think the way the Democrats need to approach this is, and the commission is, if the Republicans are making people sign, you know, blood pledges not to participate in debates, fine. Have the debate without them.
But we're talking I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're talking about the presidential debates. We're talking about the two candidate debates. I'm talking about the much earlier contests that
the
go
primaries.
On, and that go on in the primaries that are usually sponsored by a network. So CNN or ABC or Fox or whoever will have a series of debates. It seemed like there were 30 of them last time, where you would have all of those people who are running against each other, and they would have them on the stage. There were so many last time on the Democratic side that they had to winnow the field down. To Terry's point, will anybody run against Donald Trump? We already have indications that somebody will, but I don't know.
Who would do that? I don't know one person that right now would be able to pull that off. I think if Donald Trump is the designated candidate, there's not going to be a primary, because it's all about that Trump brand, and he's not going to run if he has to run against other people in a primary. I think that's where we are right now.
David?
I think that guy in Florida might have something to say about that. He's been looking to wear the mighty Trump crown ever since the results of the 2020 election. And he's been on this, 2-year campaign now. To take that position. So it's interesting, but I think that I think that this guy is going to run.
DeSantis, Abbott, Pence have all expressed interest.
I think Trump has the leverage to go to the powers that be in his party and say, if you want me to run, I will run. But if I run, you have to promise me that you will keep everybody else from running against me, and they will do it. Or he will not be on the platform. I think that's where it's going to be. So if those other people want to run, they have to find a way to get Donald Trump not to run.
Well, that's what I posited very early on when we were discussing this about the debates, that this to me was really a clear sign that Trump was very much had made up his mind to run. I mean, he's pretty much said as much, but that he was going to run, because you don't want to. You're already working on a debate schedule for something that's going to happen in 2.5 years.
And more important than that, Joe, the Republicans are working really hard on behalf of Trump to change the rules at the state level on how votes are counted and certified. It's really important to pay attention to that. We had quite the shocking experience with Arizona and Pennsylvania, and the only thing that saved democracy then was the sheer incompetence of the Trump operation. My son did send me a T-shirt that says Four Seasons Landscaping, so I'm reminded of that Rudy Giuliani news conference a lot. But they're now spending this time in between elections taking over the mechanics of voting and vote counting. Yeah. And that's where Trump has really already done a tremendous amount of damage.
We are unfortunately out of time, and I thank you all for being with us and for everyone writing in as well. David Soares, Terry Gibson, and Judith Eng, thank you. Thanks, of course, to Alan Chartok. We will be back right after this.